Right, good morning everyone. It's a real pleasure to welcome you at the Collège de France for this colloquium on cell and tissue mechanics. I'm glad to see a number of faces that were there during my lectures in the fall, and new faces as well. So we have a wonderful menu, and I would like to thank ahead of the presentation the speakers who agreed to come. Some of them came from very far away. And so we'll start with Aisha Kundering from Amolf in Amsterdam, and she will talk about cell and extracellular matrix mechanics across scales, from molecules to supramolecular networks. Thank you, Aisha.
Thank you, Thomas. And let me actually begin by thanking you for putting together a very exciting program today. And I'm very excited to be part of it, and to be allowed to kick off. And indeed, I will kick off by telling you something about mechanics of cells and tissues. And it's going to be a short journey across scales. So when you think about cells in our body, actually they have to face constant challenging mechanical demands. If you think, for instance, about our blood vessels, the endothelium that's lining our blood vessels is constantly exposed to shear flow and to tissue strains. And if you think about the heart, for instance, there's the heart muscle cells that generate contractile forces that are exposing the entire tissue continuously to large mechanical stresses. And somehow cells need to cope with these mechanical challenges. And they have to survive from anything between days to even a whole lifetime, depending on cell and tissue type. And they somehow have to stay mechanically intact. But at the same time, of course, we know that cells and tissues also need to be highly dynamic. So cells proliferate, and they do this by undergoing these dramatic shape changes where they divide, and whole tissues undergo drastic morphogenetic changes, which I think you will hear more about today. So we are really fascinated by the physics of this. How is it possible that cells and tissues are able to, on the one hand, remain mechanically intact in the face of large mechanical stresses, while at the same time they're highly dynamic? And the materials that make this possible are fibrous protein scaffolds. So when you look inside the cell, there's a filamentous scaffold of proteins that is called the cytoskeleton. And it's made up of three filamentous systems, microtubules, active filaments, and intermediate filaments, that make up this composite cytoskeleton that makes cells, on the one hand, mechanically strong and durable, but also dynamic. And if you look then in tissues around cells, there's an extracellular matrix that is also made of proteins called collagen, which assemble into these rope-like cables that provide mechanical strength to tissues while also allowing for tissue remodeling. So what we're interested in is what are the sort of material design principles of these systems. And the way that we approach this question is by a sort of reductionist approach, you could say, because what we do is we take the components of these systems, so let's say actin, tubulin, and we polymerize this in the test tube together with regulatory proteins such as crosslinkers and motors to create these bottom-up model systems that are highly controlled and that we can use to sort of dissect the design principles of cells and tissues. And today I want to take you on a short journey where I explain to you three rather universal design principles that we can see when we look at cell and tissue mechanics. The first is nonlinear elasticity, then I'll be talking about structural hierarchy, so going down all the way to the molecular scale. And finally, I will talk about the role of transient crosslinking. So let me begin with nonlinear elasticity. And as I will argue, this is really an intrinsic property of the fibrous architecture of these systems. So if you look at the literature and you look up measurements of cell and tissue mechanics, one thing that really strikes you is that cells and tissues universally exhibit a strain stiffening response. So what it means is that if, for instance, you take a cell and you measure the stiffness as a function of the stress that you apply, there's a linear regime where the modulus is constant, but once you stress it enough, the stiffness increases strongly. And the same is true if you take any tissue, in this case it's a measurement on arteries, When you deform it, you see that the stiffness at some point non-linearly increases. So this property is called strain stiffening. And already for quite a while, physicists have thought about the question how this can come about. And one way to experimentally look at this is by taking the systems, polymerizing them in the test tube, and putting them in a so-called rheometer. So this instrument is called a rheometer. It's also used to test cosmetics and food and other soft materials. It's a technique that is very macroscopic. You have two plates, and in between these plates, you put your material of interest. And then with this top plate, you can rotate in order to deform the material. So in essence, this is called a shear deformation, because you slide these two plates parallel to one another. You can control the force or the stress that you use and measure the deformation, or vice versa. And the ratio between stress and strain gives you the elastic modulus of the material. So let's say we put some material in there. In this case, we put collagen in there. And here we use different concentrations of collagen. What we can do is measure the elastic modulus as a function of the strain, which is the deformation. And you see that for all these measurements, there is this typical strain stiffening response, right? So the modulus is fairly constant and small initially, but above a certain strain, it suddenly increases drastically before finally the network ruptures. So that means that strain stiffening seems to be an intrinsic property of this collagen material. And indeed, we have several models that can, in principle, explain why strain stiffening would occur. And there are two main categories of models that are summarized here. And the first one basically assumes that your fibers are elastic beams. So if you imagine an elastic beam, it can either bend or stretch. And in general, it's going to be easier for it to bend than stretch. So if you have your network and you apply a small deformation, these fibers are going to bend. And as a result, the network is quite soft and quite easy to deform. But once you strain your network enough, you see that you get filaments aligning in this direction, and you're actually going to have a transition to a regime where the fibers are primarily stretched. And since fibers are stiffer in stretching, this can explain why the network as a whole strain stiffens. Now, the assumption here is that there's no thermal fluctuations at all, which for collagen is a pretty good assumption. But actually, many of the filaments in our cells actually do have fluctuations. So maybe you saw the movie earlier where you saw that these filaments, this is actually an actin filament, are actually wiggling. And in this case, we are in a completely different limit where the elasticity is dominated by entropy. So what happens now when you have a network and you stretch it or you shear it, you stretch out the polymer chains, you reduce their entropy, and this gives rise to an entropic resistance and therefore also strain stiffening. So these models are quite well established and they have been extensively tested also in our lab. And for instance, for collagen networks, so this is a typical collagen network, you see here one such measurement and overlaid is this dotted line, which is a theoretical model that is based, it's actually really simple, so it's based on this athermal elastic beam idea. So these are lattice models, and you can see that this theory, well, really quantitatively very nicely describes the data. And in essence, the physics here is that at this point here, there's really a phase transition where the network goes from a floppy state, and this is because it's sub-isostatic, so it has a fairly low connectivity, and when you strain it enough, it makes a phase transition to a rigid state where it's stabilized by stretching. Now, I mentioned already the filaments that are in our cells are actually fluctuating. And it means that this beam model does not apply. Instead, this entropic model applies. And you see it illustrated here. Here we measured intermediate filaments, which are some of the most resilient filaments in cells. This is fimentin. And you see that, again, there's strain stiffening. And the line here is a theoretical model, this entropic model. And again, it gives a pretty good description of the data. All right, so this is sort of one of these universal design principles. Cells and tissues are both scaffolded by filamentous materials. And these materials intrinsically strain stiffen. Now, of course, there was a huge simplification in the models. And this is that these filaments, we completely ignore their molecular structure. And you can wonder whether this internal molecular structure plays a role in the mechanics. And actually, we find that for some systems, this molecular architecture is extremely important. And I'm going to illustrate it to you with one particular material that is called fibrin. So this is this material here, which forms whenever you cut yourself and the body has to heal this wound. And what happens is that fibrinogen, which is in your plasma, goes to the rescue and it forms a blood clot that stems the bleeding and then promotes wound healing. So superficially, this looks very similar to collagen, but when we put it in the rheometer and we measure the elastic modulus as a function of deformation, we see a much more complicated response than the response we saw for collagen. And strikingly, we see that we can strain it out to extremely large strains. So you can actually calculate how much the individual fibers are stretched here, and at this point, the individual fibers are lengthened twofold. So they're stretching a lot. So then the question is, of course, where does this stretchability come from? And here the internal structure is clearly important. So one thing we're doing right now is actually look at this stretchability at the single filament level. Because whenever you do rheology, it's very macroscopic, and you have to infer what's happening at the fiber level. But we're actually now able to use so-called optical tweezers, where you have two of these micron-sized beads, and you can suspend a single filament of fibrin between them and then use the optical traps, so this is essentially laser light with which you hold these beads, to stretch the filament. So I can show it to you in a movie. This is a typical example measurement where we have a single filament and we're stretching it between these beads and we can record the force as a function of extension. And in this case we stretched it and we also go back to see how elastic, how reversible this deformation actually is. So indeed, we again observe that these fibrin fibers are very, very stretchy, and they can sustain very large deformations before they break. So then we went in search of the structural origins of this. And to look at this, we have to sort of delve into the supramolecular structure here. So fibrin is forming this filamentous network, and when you look inside the fibers, you see that they are composed of so-called protofibrils, which are very thin filaments, so they're basically bundles. And when you look inside these thin filaments, you see that they are double-stranded filaments made of these fibrin subunits. So this is the fibrin monomer. It's a symmetric molecule, it's a rod-like molecule. And what you notice is that this is actually the crystal structure, so it's highly ordered, and it has these alpha helical coiled coils. And I drew in by hand these very flexible chains, which do not show up in the crystal structure because they're flexible. And they're a very important part of the structure because they're sticking out from the molecules and they're actually mediating this bundling. And you can see they also stick out from the fibers and they mediate interactions between the fibers. So essentially, fibrin is a composite structure. It is a rigid folded domains and flexible disordered domains, which is actually quite a common design principle in biological materials. So this actually sets up a question, because it could be that the folded regions, when you stretch the fiber, will unfold, and there's actually simulations that show how this occurs. So this is an example of that, if it plays. So this is a fibrin protofibril that in silico is being stretched. And what you find is that it can be stretched a lot, and this is mediated by unfolding. However, there are also these disordered chains here, and you could actually imagine that because the fiber is a composite structure, it will be first these disordered regions that stretch, because presumably they're much easier to stretch, actually. And they're actually really long, and they can lengthen a lot when you unfold them. All right, so how do we see what is actually going on? In the rheometer, we don't see it. In the optical tweezers, we don't see it. What you need is to somehow combine a structural technique with a mechanical measurement. And one example of this is X-ray scattering. So what you can do here is that you can have your sample. In this case, we have our sample in a rheometer in Grenoble in the synchrotron beamline. And you can shine X-rays through it and measure the scattering pattern on the other side. And this is a typical scattering pattern that you see. And if you look closely, you will see that there is a ring here. And this ring is a so-called Bragg peak. So it means there's crystalline order. And that is what we are going to use. And the origin of this crystalline order is that the fibers have the monomers packed exactly in a half-staggered manner. So there's an exact 22 nanometer repeat distance that shows up as a Bragg peak. And that means we have a molecular ruler in our system. So now we can do these measurements and actually apply a mechanical shear, and we can see what happens. So this was before shearing. It's hard to see, but there is actually a ring here. And this is when we apply a 300% shear. So this is where the fibers are lengthened twofold. One thing you notice is it's now anisotropic. This is because the fibers align when you shear. And when you look closely, there's still a faint ring, but it's almost gone. Now, it's a bit difficult to see here. It's easier to see when you average these scattering patterns. Then you get the intensity, the scattering intensity, as a function of wave factor. The wave factor is basically the inverse of a length. And you see that there's this decay with, on top of it, these little peaks. And this is this Bragg peak. This is the ring. And what you notice is when you go from 0% to 100% to 300% strain, there is only a very small shift here. So even though the fibers are stretched twofold, the molecular length is almost unchanged. However, what does change is the height of the peak. So the height of the peak is going down almost to zero. So what it means is that we are somehow destroying molecular packing order. And that is plotted here. So here you see again this strain stiffening response together with the peak position and the peak height. So you see that in the regime at very large strains where the fibers are being extended, there's hardly any change in the peak position, but there is actually a very large change at the same time in the peak height. And our interpretation of this is that it is indeed these disordered linkers that are mediating the stretching. Because the fact that there's almost no change in molecular length, even though the fibers are lengthening so much, means that there's hardly any unfolding. So it has to be the disordered linkers that are stretching here. So this is actually a really smart design principle. So by having this composite hierarchical structure, fibrin can use these natively disordered regions to increase its resilience. And as I mentioned, this is actually something that's also used by other biological materials and something that we can also emulate in designer materials. And unfolding actually provides an extra mechanism to prevent failure. And in addition to this, also sliding between subunits provides yet another backup mechanism so that the system as a whole is extremely resilient. All right, now finally, I want to talk briefly about transient cross-linking. Because so far we were looking at systems that were sort of permanently cross-linked and therefore purely elastic. But if we look in the cell, actually clearly the cell is a viscoelastic material. It's also in addition active, I will not talk about that. But in addition it's also viscoelastic. And that means that time scales are important. And you can see it very nicely if you take the rheometer and we put an actin network inside. So we have an actin network here that is cross-linked with alpha-actinin, which is a cross-linker protein that can connect filaments together. And what we can do is we can oscillate the top plate like this to apply an oscillatory shear strain. In this case, we apply a very small magnitude so that we're in a linear regime. We just change the frequency. So at high frequencies, we are measuring on short timescales, and at low frequencies, we're measuring on long timescales. And what you see is the elastic modulus, and this is the viscous modulus. So obviously, when you apply a fast deformation at high frequencies, the material is elastic, because the crosslinkers do not have any time to exchange. But if you stress the system slowly enough, there is plenty of time for crosslinkers to dissociate. So there will be a typical frequency where there is a maximum in the viscous modulus that corresponds to the off rate of the cross-linking molecules. Now this is at low loads. Now, of course, when you load the system, you're going to change the off rate. And typically what happens is that when you consider the bond lifetime of these crosslinks, the bond lifetime will decrease as you apply the force, consistent with the well-known Bell's law. And if you translate that to the network scale, what it means is that these systems exhibit stochastic rupture. There's continuous unbinding and rebinding of crosslinkers. But at some point, the system will catastrophically rupture when you load it. And this is an example of such a measurement. We increase the stress, we ramp it up, we measure the deformation, so the system can deform until suddenly it collapses and it completely loses its integrity. And this is really a stochastic phenomenon that we can also model. I don't have time to talk about that. So the dynamics of the crosslinkers have a big impact on this behavior. And we can show that actually by taking the same system and varying the temperature. And by varying the temperature, we can change the typical off rate of the crosslinkers. So at low temperature, the bond lifetime is longer than at high temperature. So this is a nice switch to test the impact of the bond lifetime. And you see here that actually at high temperature, the stress where the system fails, at low temperature, the stress where the system fails is much higher than at high temperature. So the faster the exchange of the crosslinkers, the smaller the robustness of the system. Okay? So dynamics compromises system integrity. Now, interestingly, there's a way around this problem, because this is a bit of a problem maybe, but cells have an interesting way to solve that problem. Because they have some crosslinkers that have a very different type of force-dependent bond lifetime. And these crosslinkers are called catch bonds. They also appear in other biological contexts, but the biological context here is the cytoskeleton. So one crosslinker where this behavior has been demonstrated quite convincingly is called alpha-actinin, which is the crosslinker that I was already talking about, which has two actin binding domains on its two ends by which it can connect actin filaments. And if you look at this actin binding domain, it's basically two calponin homology domains, and there has been some structural work on this, and it was shown that there's somehow a hidden binding site that can probably be exposed and increase the bond lifetime when you load the system. So if you sketch the expected bond lifetime as a function of force, you expect this behavior, where initially the lifetime increases when you load, and this is because of this exposure of the hidden binding site. But of course, when you increase the force further, you're going back to the so-called slip bond behavior. Now, you might think maybe this, actually I wanted to say this, maybe some people in the audience know the Chinese finger trap. So it's a similar kind of idea, but this is a more macroscopic equivalent. The more you load it, the stronger it becomes. And maybe intuitively you would think, yes, of course, that makes the material stronger. But actually, the more we thought about it, the more clear it is that it is actually not so obvious. So if you think about the alpha-actinin example, we have a very nice way of looking into the advantage of catch bonds, because there's a point mutation, K255E, available, which abrogates this behavior. So this point mutant actually, in its unloaded state, forms a very strong bond. So it has this bond lifetime behavior. It's a slip bond, but when you don't load it, it's actually stronger than the catch bond. So already it's not so obvious that the catch bond would give you an advantage, right? Because we just saw that dynamic crosslinkers compromise integrity. Nevertheless, when we do these typical fracture experiments where we load the system and measure the deformation, so this is a typical measurement for a catch bond cross-linked system. So this is with a wild type alpha-actinin, and this is with a slip bond, so this is with a mutant. And you see that indeed, actually, the catch bond cross-linked system has a much larger rupture stress. So it is, in fact, stronger. And also, at the same time, it's more deformable. So this is really nice. By being both more dynamic, but also having this catch bond behavior, it can increase the rupture strength, but also allow for deformability. So this is, from a materials design principle idea, a very nice design principle. Now, I don't have much time to talk about the details here, but we're able to explain this behavior by a very simple 1D model. So what I show here are 1D simulations, where you imagine that you have two plates that are cross-linked by transient cross-linkers, where each cross-link site can have a cross-linker that can freely exchange with the bulk. And we assume that the on-rate is very large, that it's just diffusion limited. And what we can then do is load the system and measure its rupture behavior as a function of applied stress. And what we find is actually, if we measure the mean distance between occupied binding sites, it's actually, for the catch bond system, larger. And this is because these catch bonds actually are more dynamic than the slip bonds. So in principle, you would say this is not good for rupture strength. But if you look at the histogram of bond distances, the interesting thing is that for the catch bond, this distribution is much narrower than for the slip bond. All right? So that means that if you have slip bonds, you have very large bond distances, which are essentially defects, which can give rise to eventually rupture. So it's really because the fluctuations are smaller here that catch bonds protect the system. So basically what happens is that catch bonds can redistribute to regions that are experiencing a high stress and create a more homogeneously cross-linked system. So to sum up, all of these principles we can find in the cytoskeleton, some of them also in the accessory matrix. Strain stiffening is a very general feature of fibrous networks, and it's certainly advantageous because it can protect cells and tissues against large deformations. It prevents large deformations. And some proteins on top of this have a very smart hierarchical design, which makes use of these intrinsically disordered, long and flexible regions to increase their resilience. And surprisingly, even transient networks can be very robust, but only if they make use of these special bonds called catch bonds, which can increase the robustness. So with this, I would like to finish, but not before mentioning Yuval, Bart, and Anders, who did the work that I showed today. Thank you.